We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. Or visit preborn.com.
Helping women save babies. That's the goal of the Safe Haven Law. And there's an Indiana ministry using it with effective results. Safe Haven Baby Boxes has patented and produced safe and comfortable medical bassinets and located them outside designated safe places. Parents can leave an infant where it will be recovered by trained personnel in just a couple of minutes. You really need to know about this life-saving ministry. Read Indiana Ministry Saving Abandoned Babies at afa.net/thestand.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Welcome to Jenna Ellis in the Morning. No, Jenna does not have a cold. There's not a frog in her throat. My name is Abraham Hamilton III. I am filling in for Jenna on this auspicious occasion this morning. Thank you for tuning in to the American Family Radio Network. I usually host the Hamilton Corner that airs in the evenings right here on American Family Radio from 5.05 p.m. Central to 6.05 p.m. Central Time, or from 6 to 7 Eastern Time. So I'm usually accompanying the American Family Radio audience on their way home from work. This morning, I get to roll with you on your way in. So I am grateful for doing so, and I still will be on live this evening as well. So I certainly invite you to join us this evening right here on the American Family Radio Network. I am grateful to be with you this morning. Looking forward to having a wonderful, wonderful time during this hour of the broadcast. I wanted to begin this morning the same way I usually start my program in the evenings, by turning to the Word of God. I think it's vitally important that as we endeavor to navigate the issues of the day, that we refuse to set our Bibles aside and try to joust with human ingenuity and natural reasoning, but we should always bring the Word of God to bear on any circumstance, any occasion. And this morning, as you're making your way into what I describe as your part-time jobs, because what you do to generate an income does not identify you, nor is it your entire function or primary function if you are indeed a member of the Lord's eternal family. Your full-time job actually is outcome cultivation. Every single believer is called to execute the Great Commission. Contrary to what is popularly practiced, every believer is called into ministry. We must all have our hands to the plow. The only question or variable is what is the particular context that God has placed us in. I also often remind, not often, daily remind the Hamilton Corner audience that what goes on in your house is far more important than what goes on in the White House. The world works feverishly to get us to place importance, to place priority, to establish kind of a hierarchy of importance in our own minds and hearts on everything outside of our families, only to neglect our own homes. But I want to encourage you to reverse that, man. Refuse to allow your home to be ignored or neglected or shelved in your efforts to be fruitful and faithful in the world. But let's start that fruitfulness and faithfulness right in our own homes. This morning, I want to turn your attention to the story of Abram, who many of you know became Abraham. What a beautiful name. Kind of like that name. But I want to focus on him before even the Lord changed his name to Abraham, to talk a bit about his journey, and just to provide a bit of encouragement for you this morning as you're making your way, many of you, if not most of you, making your way to your occupations. I'm going to start in Genesis chapter 11, verse 26. I'm going to go on into chapter 12, right to about verse 10. Just as a reminder, in the original manuscripts in the Old Testament, they're going to be Hebrew manuscripts. There are no chapter and verse demarcations, so I don't want to make anybody nervous by crossing that that border between chapters 11 and 12 as we navigate this portion of the text. But beginning in Genesis chapter 11, I'll read Genesis chapter 11, verses 26 through 31 first, then I'll take a break, then go into verses 1 through 10 in Genesis chapter 12. This is what the Word of God says. When Terah had lived 70 years, he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran fathered Lot. And Haran died in the presence of his father, Terah, in the land of his kindred, in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was barren. She had no child. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now, I wanted to start here because a lot of times when we talk about Abram, the patriarch of the faith, the progenitor of the Hebrew people, and the term Hebrew actually is derived from the way the Canaanites described Abram once he enters what we know becomes the promised land, because they refer to him as Eber, which means you're from over there. You're not from here natively. You're not native to this region. You're from another place, but you've migrated to this place. But I wanted to begin with Terah, because Terah, T-E-R-A-H, is Abram's father. The Bible tells us that Terah, Abram, Nahor, Haran, who is Lot's father, they're all Chaldean, ethnically, Babylonian, from the place where modern-day Iraq is. So what we have here is Yahweh introducing himself to Abram when we get to chapter 12 and beginning the Hebrew people, but the Hebrew people derive originally from Terah and those who populated Ur of the Chaldees, okay? Now, what I want you to note is that the move from Ur, from Babylon, from modern-day Iraq, toward Canaan did not begin with Abram, but it actually starts with his father. All right? I'll point you again to Genesis chapter 11, verse 31. It says, Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. So if you track the trajectory from Ur of the Chaldees across the Fertile Crescent, Haran is the area that is north geographically from where Canaan ultimately what becomes Israel is. So they go across from Ur, southward somewhat, and then settle in Haran. And Terah, Abram's father, dies while they are living in Haran. All right. The trek from Ur to Canaan begins with Terah, not with Abram. Then we come to Genesis chapter 12. I'll read all the way to verse 10, and I want to make just one particular point from this. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors or curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abram went as the Lord told him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. When they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak at Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed on still, going toward the Negev. Now there was famine in the land. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. Now, what you see here, and I often describe this as the making of a man of God, because remember, Terah, Abram, their family, they were Chaldeans, all right? What we have in chapter 12, Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, we have the first recording of God speaking to Abram, all right? He's introducing himself to Abram, and at this introduction, God calls Abram to leave his relatives, to leave the country that had become familiar to him in Haran, which is, again, north of Canaan, which was a summoning of Abram to exercise confidence and faith in the Lord. All right? God speaks to Abram directly for the first time, instructing him to leave his father's household and to go to the land that he, God, would show him. Now, I've heard people attempt to convey that Abram didn't know anything about Canaan, didn't know where it was. It was something that God was going to show him. That's not true. Remember, Terah is the one who began heading towards Canaan. What the Lord is revealing to Abram in this instance is that he would show Abram the land in a different light. The word in Hebrew that's used to describe the phrase, I will show you, is ra'ah, which means to reveal or to present with revelatory insight. It's not that Abram was unaware where Canaan was, but he simply wasn't aware that this will become his inheritance and that of his offspring. All right? The main thing I want you to see thereafter, because the Lord introduces himself to Abram by calling him to abandon all that was normalized and comfortable for him and to follow him. And he says, I will show you this land, bring you to this land that's for you and for your offspring. The Lord also says, in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. It's important to note that God's establishment as Abram as the progenitor of the Hebrew people was for the ultimate purpose of blessing the entire world. It wasn't just for the Hebrew people, but for the entire world, which, of course, we know later, Messiah comes through this lineage, which is how the whole world is blessed. But one of the first things that Abram encounters when he enters the promised land, verse 10 shows us. When Abram enters the promised land, verse 10 says, now there was famine in the land. And this is what I want to spend a few moments talking to you about. What do you do when there's famine in the promised land? This is a land that God certainly summoned the formerly pagan Chaldean towards. This is the land that the Lord summoned Abram to as he's introducing himself to Abram and moving him to become a man of God. What do you do when there's famine in the promised land? We as people, we have a tendency to navigate and to interpret circumstances based upon their natural occurrences. Many of us in that instance, when the Lord directs Abram to the promised land and one of the first things he encounters there is famine, that will provoke many of us to begin to think, well, man, to begin to doubt. Wait, is this where I'm supposed to be? You know, I know that I've had experiences when the Lord has directed me, you know, and difficulty arises, certain things transpire. It can cause you to begin to question. But did I miss it here? Here's what I want to tell you. The fact that one of the first things that Abram encountered in the land that God promised him was famine did not nullify or negate the fact that God called him there. When we are followers of the Lord Jesus Christ, when we are believers in the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and he gives us direction, he leads us. Remember, Jesus told us one of the things that he would do by his Spirit was lead us and guide us in all truth, that he's given us his word to anchor us, to ground us. The Spirit of God would never lead us in any way that would contradict what the written, revealed word of God would say to us. But as we're endeavoring to discern the Lord's will, to follow the Lord's direction, to pursue the Lord's course in our lives, we must refuse to allow circumstances to dictate to us how we interpret where we are. Because it's very easy to receive the fact that, wait a minute, the Lord called me to this promised land. I'm here, Lord. And the first thing I encounter, one of the first things, is famine. It's easy to say, man, maybe I missed it. When we are following the Lord, it is our privilege and prerogative to remain tethered to his word and refuse to be circumstantially moved or motivated professing believers. One of the unfortunate realities of modern day Christianity is that we have lots of people who are professing Christians, but we're practical atheists. And what I mean by practical atheists, we live as if there is no God. Just because there may be difficulty in the direction in which the Lord leads you doesn't mean the Lord is not leading you. Oftentimes, the Lord uses difficulty, ministers to us through difficulty, to give us a girth and a heft to our faith in Him. Unsurprisingly, God uses the sojourn time that Abram goes into Egypt to provide him the resources that he will need later on to provide the robust heritage for his people. The presence of famine in the promised land doesn't negate the fact that God called Abram to that promised land. As God calls you, the presence of difficulty doesn't nullify the fact that he's leading and directing you. When those situations occur, refuse to deviate. Continue following the course that God has set before you, because rejoicing is on the other side of obedience.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning. I am filling in for Jenna. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, host of the Hamilton Corner right here on American Family Radio. You can hear me usually live in the evenings at 5 p.m. Central Time or 6 p.m. Central Time. This morning, I have the privilege of joining you on your way in to work, in addition to riding with you on your way home this evening. We were just talking a little bit about Abram and a little bit about his journey. And again, I just want to encourage you, man, to continue pressing forward in what God has called you to. We need, as the body of Christ, we need every joint to supply. In this crazy world that we're living in, I often say, I never intended for this to become a catchphrase or anything, but darkness is not an affirmative force. It merely reoccupies the space that is vacated by the light. We know this intuitively because not one of us goes home at the end of a long day and says, "Hey, honey, would you turn the darkness off?" No, we know that all that's necessary to address the darkness is to turn the light on. But the thing about darkness is it has a good marketing department. You know, its advertising is strong. You know, it has the appearance of ubiquity, you know. But all that needs to be done in order to address it is to turn the light on. Now, last night, there was an interesting report. A lot of us know that we have a porous southern border. But what some people may not be aware of is that it's not really people coming across our southern border exclusively from Mexico anymore. They're coming from all over the world. And you had a Fox News correspondent, Bill Mulligan, who was on our southern border, but not limited to the areas of Texas and Arizona. He was in California, particularly in Jacumba, just east of San Diego. And at about 2 a.m., he went through with camera crew and microphones in tow to query what seemed to be a large amount of military-age men as to where they had come to our shores from. And they had entered into our country illegally, right across the border between near San Diego in California and Mexico. I want you to listen to this clip. It's clip number 3.
Where are you guys from? What country?
Pakistan.
Pakistan.
India.
India. Where are you from?
Turkey.
Turkey?
Yeah.
Turkey. Okay.
India.
India. Where are you guys from?
Turkey.
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 Turkey. Where are you guys from?
China.
China.
Ecuador.
Ecuador? Where are you guys from?
India.
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 India. Sagar Baba.
India. India.
India.
India.
India.
India.
India.
India.
India.
India.
India.
India.
India.
All India?
India.
India. Iran.
Iran.
You're all from Iran. Why'd you come?
No freedom.
No freedom?
Yes, in Iran. Iran is a dangerous country. No freedom for speak, for writing, for singing, for thinking.
Now, man, I wish you could have saw that video along with listening to that audio. But when you see the large numbers of people from India and Pakistan and Bangladesh, it should cause us to wonder what is really going on here. Because in order for these guys, and I'm saying guys because they all were men, to enter our country, they're entering through Mexico. But these cats ain't Mexican, man. You have large amounts of people coming from Middle Eastern countries, hotbeds of Islamic terrorism. And Devin helped me out. The correspondent's name was Bill Malugin. I mispronounced his last name. Sorry, Bill. But what is going on here? You know, earlier this year, the largest numbers of illegal aliens entering our country through our southern border actually came from China. I've explained in the past, and I'll explain here again, in order to truly understand what's happening at our southern border, you have to toggle back to the Cloward-Piven strategy. The Cloward-Piven strategy was developed by these regressive professors in New York City, and I call them regressives because I know they would call themselves progressive, but as former President Calvin Coolidge would say, that these types of people don't advance humanity at all. The only way they move is backward, hence my description of them as regressive. But Frances Fox Piven and her husband Richard Cloward were Marxists who had the objective of toppling the established municipal government in the city of New York and replacing it with a Marxist substitute. In order to do so, they developed a strategy to overwhelm the welfare rolls in the city of New York. How did they go about doing this? Well, first, they advocated for the municipality to pass a massive welfare package. Second, what they sought to do, knowing the constrictions, knowing the confines of the New York City's budget, they sought to inflate the welfare rolls. They aggressively used people to go all around the city to add as many people to the welfare rolls as possible, regardless if they qualify for the programs. They just wanted their names added. Now, mind you, they had no intention for the people who were signing up for these welfare benefits to actually receive them. This is not merely my opinion. They published an article describing this called The Weight of the Poor. And when they described the weight of the poor, W-E-I-G-H-T, they described it as a weight, like an anvil that's used to break what they call the status quo or the hegemony. So they inflated the welfare rolls, never intending for any of these people to receive the welfare they were signing up for, and to force the city into bankruptcy, to overwhelm the city, to force it into bankruptcy so they would have no other choice but to seek massive adjustments to their policy. And stop, you've heard this before, massive wealth distribution to respond to the overwhelming of the welfare state. What is happening on our southern border, guys, is not an accident. It's not an accident. I know Jenna has covered on this show how the Biden administration, in an effort to avoid the quantity of illegals entering our nation through the southern border, they're flying them in. So you're booking flights. You're having communications. You know, a lot of people were in different airports, at Chicago O'Hare and in Atlanta and other places, and they had these black curtains up. What's going on here? You had people, illegal aliens, living in the airports until they could get their parole benefits to enter our country. Well, you have, some of us may recall, during the Trump administration and even prior administrations, you had people that advocated for illegal aliens saying things like, all 11 million need to be made citizens. But just in the first 3 years of the Biden administration, the accepted number is 7 million in 3 years. So that lets you know it's way more than 11 million before. But there's no way anyone could say that, oh, we just don't know what's going on our southern border. No, what's happening is intentional. And what's happening is the exportation of the Cloward-Piven strategy to the context of immigration. There are people who, stop me if you heard this before, let me be clear, we need to fundamentally transform the United States of America. The fundamental transformation is continuing, folks. The crises at the border is not a crisis. It's a planned phenomenon that's being fomented intentionally because they're using the massive influx of illegal immigrants as a means to execute the fundamental transformation of our nation. It's not the exclusive means, but it is a means that is being employed. When you see, wait a minute, you have people from India and Pakistan and Bangladesh and China and Turkey, and they're all entering our country through the southern border. That ain't a coinkydink, folks. That ain't a coinkydink. And I'm sharing this with you, and others share this with you, so that we can be aware of what's going on. And so that we can be, so there can be a disabusal of this notion. This is just, we don't know what to do. No, we know what to do with the border. Everybody understands how the border was securely under control under former President Trump and how the Biden administration, Mr. J. Robinette, and him and his ice cream, had made the decision to expressly reverse everything that was done under former President Trump, which should be a caution for us and for any subsequent occupants of the Oval Office that we have to pursue enduring measures beyond executive action only, because executive action can be reversed with the changing of the guard. And so now, because during President Trump's administration, there was no lasting implemented control mechanisms applied to our southern border, executive action has allowed what we're experiencing now. And it's slowly affecting places, because you have, like, Eric Adams in New York City. We can no longer continue with the status quo. We cannot continue to have criminal migrants. And that's not the tune he was singing when he first came into office, but it's a tune that he's singing now. And then it was also interesting to me how, you know, Bill Malugin talked to this one guy. He's like, he's from Iran, you know. And I just, some of you may know, over the weekend, a helicopter crashed, leaving Azerbaijan, heading back into Tehran, that we now know has been confirmed that included Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi, who's passed away. And I just found it curious, man, that the Biden administration sends condolences to the nation of Iran in the passing of Ibrahim Raisi, while many in Iran were celebrating, because President Raisi is known as the butcher of Tehran. Now, as always, when we consider the loss of life, my mind immediately goes to the fact that unless this man, Ibrahim Raisi, repented of his sins and placed his faith in Jesus Christ, he's going to spend eternity in hell. Which always is a sobering consideration for me, and presents an urgency of the necessity of proclaiming the gospel. Many in Iran, and before Raisi became president, he was one of the, you know, judges who presided over the extrajudicial murder of thousands of Iranians. I can't imagine a U.S. presidential administration sending condolences for Adolf Hitler. What are we doing here? And to have a stark contrast, just recently, there was a statue in Washington, D.C., erected in honor of Billy Graham. I might have missed it, but I don't remember seeing the Biden administration send any acknowledgments or anything to the Graham family in light of Billy Graham having a statue erected in his honor in our Capitol. I just find that to be a very startling and strident contrast of interests. Oh, yeah, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, because it's the same Biden administration that sent $6 billion to Iran, the largest state sponsor of terror in the world, that actually is the reason why Hamas has resources, because Hamas is an extremity of the Iranian government, which is why there were missiles launched against Israel from Iran. And it followed Mr. Let me be clear, who sends pallets of cash overnight to the same. I guess I shouldn't be surprised that birds of a feather are sending condolences together. I'll move on. But I just thought that was rather interesting. I have a rather disturbing story now I want to cover that comes to us from Maryland, in particular, Montgomery County School District in Maryland, as well as the United States District Court in Maryland and the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. You had three families in Maryland, particularly, who had children enrolled in Montgomery County elementary schools in their kindergarten through fifth grade programs. That's who the families represent. The families are include one Christian family, one Muslim family, and one Ethiopian Orthodox Jewish family. They sued the Montgomery County School District because a law in the state of Maryland says that parents have the right to review materials that provide teaching and instruction on family life and human sexuality objectives, and would give the families the right to opt out of that instructional material if they found it to be objectionable or a violation of their faith. In light of Maryland's law, the school district implemented a policy that coincided with the Maryland state law. However, the policy of the school district added in an escape clause, you see. The school district, the Montgomery County School District's policy included a clause that states, quote, if such requests, that is the opt-out requests, quote, if such requests become too frequent or too burdensome, the school may refuse to accommodate the requests. Schools are not required to alter fundamentally the educational program or create a separate educational program or separate course to accommodate a student's religious practice or beliefs. Well, there's a problem there because there's this thing I'm trying to remember. Adam, you, yeah, the First Amendment. Yeah, there's the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That's right. It says governments, which, by the way, public school districts are an extremity of government, cannot infringe upon the free exercise of one's religion. Well, the Montgomery County School District said, though we're supposed to give you an opt-out, we ain't doing that no more. We're not giving opt-outs anymore. And so these three families sued. The music has started, so I'm going to hold my powder on this until we get to the other side of the break. But I'm going to play a clip for you to give you an idea of what's happening on the legal front. But I want to go a bit deeper to show you what some of the items are included in the Montgomery County Public School, the Montgomery County District Public Schools curricula that led to these families saying, oh no, I am opting out of this. This is indoctrination that I will not abide. When we get back, we'll hear what the courts have decided. Can we as parents still control what our children will and will not be taught? You don't want to miss the rest of this. Stay with us right here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Abraham Hamilton III here sitting in for Jenna. Before we went to the break, I was explaining to you some of the factual foundational issues in this case out of Maryland. Now, I mentioned to you three families sued the Montgomery County School District because the state law says parents must be given the opportunity to review materials particularly concerning family life and teaching sexuality objectives. And upon review, they have to be allowed to opt out. Well, the school district implemented a policy that said, well, you can opt out unless the request to opt out become too repetitive or too burdensome. How do you like that amorphous term? Burdensome for the school district? How do they assess whether or not it's too burdensome to have some of the children opt out? But I wanted to give you a bit of insight as to what these families were attempting to opt their children out of. All right. And contrary to what the district court judge in this case ruled, you don't have to go too far to find out what exactly it is the parents are trying to opt out from. For example, on the Montgomery County School District's own website, they have a LGBT section that says, quote, we have welcoming, affirming schools, classrooms, teams, and clubs. We value all of our children, youth, teachers, staff, and parents. There's also a coming out as you guide on the Montgomery County Schools website, in which the guide instructs children on how to come out safely by having a safety plan, which instructs students to make sure they have a place to go outside of their home and to stay seemingly with someone other than their parents or family, saying that these are trusted people, those you can trust. It gives them step by step how to about doing this. Then on this particular school's website, they have a culturally responsive supplemental elementary collection, an ELA collection. Remember, the families have children from kindergarten to fifth grade. All right. Here's a couple of the offerings in the Montgomery County Public Schools culturally responsive supplemental elementary collection that these families were required. One is a book for kindergartners to second grade. The book is titled Born Ready, the story of a boy named Penelope. According to the description of the book, quote, Penelope knows that he's a boy and a ninja. The problem is getting everyone else to realize it, end quote. Of course, Penelope is a girl in the book, but you see, she feels like a boy. Hence the title, The Story of a Boy Named Penelope. Then you have three books that focus on a character named Max. Max is a transgender-identifying elementary school-age student who dedicates time to educating friends and teachers and parents about what being transgender means. There are three books on this that are part of the curriculum that these families would have had their children from kindergarten to fifth grade have to read. Then you have the next set of offerings, several books that focus on same-sex relationships. One is about a prince and a knight who fall in love. One about a child's gay uncle getting married. And then a book for 4 to 8-year-olds titled Love, Violet, which is about an elementary age girl who falls in love with another girl. Now, did I mention this is for kindergartners to fifth grade? Then Not Being Subtle at All, another title that's a part of the collection that these families' children would have to read, is a book titled Intersection Allies, We Make Room for All. This is a book on intersectional feminism that teaches children how to be activists. I'm just mentioning these because it gives you a sense of the types of material that these families wanted to opt their children out of. And when the school district said, no, it's too burdensome for you to opt out, we're not going to let you opt out, they had to file a lawsuit. I want you to listen to a brief clip on this. It's clip number one. Go.
It is an issue that Fox 5 has covered extensively for the last year. Thousands of parents gathering at rallies, protests, and school board meetings. On Wednesday, a divided federal appeals court ruled that Maryland parents cannot opt their children out of LGBTQ inclusive book curriculum in classrooms. This stems from a lawsuit brought by parents in Montgomery County. Eric Baxter is the senior counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, representing roughly 300 parents, Muslims, Christians, and Ethiopian Orthodox, who want to be able to excuse their pre-K to fifth grade students from those specific materials.
Issues around sexuality that are simply too mature for such young children.
Interestingly, U.S. District Judge Deborah Boardman, who had the case initially, dismissed the parents' complaints. And in so doing, she ruled, quote, the mere exposure in public school to ideas that contradict religious beliefs does not burden the religious exercise of students or parents. The parents still may instruct their children on their religious beliefs regarding sexuality, marriage and gender, and each family may place contrary views in its religious context. No government action prevents the parents from freely discussing the topics raised in the storybooks with their children or teaching their children as they wish. With all due respect, Judge Boardman, which shall follow with some disrespect, you got to be out of your mind. She's literally saying that, well, you know, who cares if the children learn this stuff at school? You can do what you want at home, parents, but when you send them to the school, you see, they belong to the school. That's what the judge is saying. Of course, the parents appealed that decision up to the appellate court for the Fourth Circuit. The U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals governs cases from Maryland, North and South Carolina, Virginia and West Virginia. And the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that, well, it's too early to vindicate the parents' claims because we don't really know how the books will be used in the curriculum. What? The material I just provided for you was actually submitted to the court in briefs. This is not about just learning about different types of people. This is clear indoctrination. As it stands currently, the Fourth Circuit's decision represents the notion that parents may no longer have the right to opt their children out of this type of indoctrination. Now, to be fair, the case at the appellate court was at the preliminary injunction stage, so it has not ruled on the merits. They made reference to the possibility of developing the record more in order to truly assess how the material will be used, but it's pretty obvious how the material is going to be used. And it boils down to this. You remember the guy was running for governor in Virginia? He was governor previously, but he lost to the current governor of Virginia. I forgot his name. McAuliffe. That's his name, McAuliffe. And the reason why he lost was because he said parents should not have the authority to determine what children learn in public schools. Remember that? Seems like Judge Boardman in the United States District Court in Maryland and the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals at this juncture is agreeing with him. My question is, do you agree with that? See, I often refer to the Maya Angelou maxim. When people show you who they are, believe them. We are dealing with a divergence in worldview. So you have people that really believe, hey, you send your children here, they belong to me. This is why homeschooling and other alternatives are growing so robustly. Because people are like, Papa, I done stands all I can stand and I can't stands no more. I'm not doing it. This is sick. And this is happening in our very own country where the courts are hosting a fight that will ultimately determine whether or not parents have the authority to parent if they decide to enter into a partnership with the government concerning their children's education. Now, I'm going to deviate from that briefly because there's been a rare instance on this network called Comedy Central where they actually had something that was kind of funny. It was surprising to me to see this because with all things being infected with partisanship, things that used to be comical are just not comical anymore. But the Daily Show took aim at the current vice presidential mansion occupant, who I unaffectionately refer to as Cackling Kamala. It seems Kamala Harris didn't really think about what she's going to say before she produces those ridiculous word salads. She employs the assistance of a holistic thought advisor. Listen to this clip. Clip number two. Go.
I lead the vice president on not so much sentences as idea voyages.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree? You exist in the context of all in which you live and what came before you.
It's a process I call speaking without thinking. It's not about the destination of the thought. It's about the journey and how many words you use to describe the journey.
That's on top of everything else that we know and don't know yet. Based on what we've just been able to see, and because we've seen it or not doesn't mean it hasn't happened.
I lead the vice president, not in forming sentences, but idea voyages. Where it's an exercise in speaking without thinking. Where it's not about the destination and what you're trying to say, but it's about the journey and how many words you can use to get there. Oh, my God. Oh, this is funny. You guys, I mean, that was just a snippet of the word salad that she often produces that makes sense to no one. To no one. This is the same cackling Kamala who ran for the presidency, the Democrat nomination for the presidency, who didn't get 1% of the Democrat primary vote, yet she was tapped to be vice president. All right, that's what you want to roll with? It was surprising to me that The Daily Show was willing to even crack that joke, you know, because it seems like the only people that they're willing to make fun of these days, and I'm talking about The Daily Show and all the different historically comedic outfits, are people who they disagree with politically. So to see that was a departure, which communicates to me more than just the truth about her use of word salad, but the fact that she still remains rather unpopular with people who would normally agree with her ideologically. And it is interesting to see that play out on the national stage. And we only have a few minutes left with today's program, but I want to come full circle to where I began the program, really with the scriptural exhortation and the scriptural encouragement that just as, you know, Abram comes into the promised land, and I love seeing how you have this former pagan to be made into a man of God. The Lord calls him, gives him direction, begins the cultivation of relationship with him, and then one of the first things that he encounters in following the Lord's call for him is famine in the promised land. And it's easy to misunderstand and misinterpret those circumstances, but the faith that we have is one that as we grow and as we mature, we actually are instructed to count it all joy even when we suffer difficulty. Because when we have confidence in the one who leads us, we can rest in the fact that even the trying of our faith has a greater work, a greater ending afoot, that it produces endurance in us, perseverance in us, the capacity of having constancy under trial. Maturity is not solely the product of years spent on the Lord's earth. You know, the Bible even tells us a hoary head or a gray head is a crown of life if it be found in the way of righteousness. That really presents to us that the conditions exist where you could have a hoary head, but it's not found in the way of righteousness. Therefore, it's not a crown of life. Maturity in the Lord is the product of time spent on the Lord's earth, obeying the Lord's instructions, submitting to his commands, yielding to his lordship, embracing his lordship. That is how maturity is produced. So even if you're in a place where you're endeavoring to follow the Lord, you've hit a rocky spot, you've hit some difficulty, you've hit some turbulence, don't allow the turbulence to cause you to all of a sudden abandon your commitment to the one who called you. But recognize that even when there's famine in the promised land, faithful is he who called you, because he will certainly perform what he has called you to. It has truly been my pleasure to be here with you this morning, filling in for Jenna. I welcome you to join us this evening on the Hamilton Corner, where we will be live this evening at 5 p.m. Central Time. I think we always have a great time in the corner. I welcome you to join us there as you go forward with your day today. I want to encourage you to exalt the King of Glory. Live your life to the full, in full view and in full scope of the one who has called you. As believers, we do all things heartily as unto the Lord. Let your day be filled with your working with your hands, working with your heart, working with your mind heartily as unto the Lord. Not looking for the accolades of men, but living before the audience of one. As the Lord had it said about Samuel, a boy wearing a linen ephod, He ministered unto the Lord, though he was in the physical presence of Eli. When you go about your day today, you are ministering unto the Lord, regardless of the quantity or the lack thereof of people who may be with you. Again, Abraham Hamilton III here, filling in for Jenna Ellis. You all have a wonderful day.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.